The next case this morning is 523-0084, People v. O'Daniel. Arguing for the appellant is Patrick Daly. Arguing for the appellee is Yasmin Navi. Each side will have 10 minutes for their argument. The appellant will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please note, only the clerk of the court is permitted to record these proceedings today.
Morning, counsel.
Morning, Your Honor.
Just a couple things. Thank you for your patience. We were running a little late due to some technical difficulties. Hopefully we have those squared away. Clerk Kuntze, I know you said earlier there were a couple non-video participants. Are they able to see the argument?
They are coming now.
Okay. I just want to make sure that we have them in.
They're here, Judge Bowie.
Okay. I'm just making sure they're muted. Okay. With all that being said, Mr. Daly, you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Then go right ahead.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning, Your Honors, and good morning, counsel. May it please the court. My name is Patrick Daly, and I'm appearing here on behalf of the people of the state of Illinois. As this court is aware, this is an appeal by the state of a judgment of the trial court excluding slash suppressing a video recorded interrogation of the defendant on the basis of the certain aspects of the video which the court had determined would be unfairly prejudicial to the defendant, and that would have weighed the outweighed the probative value of the evidence statement's contents. I think before we get into all that, the defendant has raised a jurisdictional challenge, and I think that this is something this court needs to address. We all need to address, I think, out of the gate. This court actually has an independent duty to determine its jurisdiction, whether to consider an appeal. And so I want to devote the first part of my argument to this aspect of the case. This is, under Rule 604A, the state is permitted to appeal the exclusion of evidence that would substantially impair the state's case's ability to proceed. However, a body of law is developed from the Supreme Court and even this court as well, as we'll discuss in a moment, which has come to the conclusion as held that if the state has other means by which to present the same information, then there's not really a suppression of evidence as contemplated under Rule 604A, because the state could proceed along to present that other means of presenting the evidence, and therefore there's not really a 604 issue because that evidence has not been excluded. I think that it's important at the outset to understand that my perception of the issue here relates to the fact that the court's order of suppression excluded the video, but did not necessarily exclude the defendant's statements per se. In other words, that the defendant's statements could still be introduced by perhaps the testimony of the officer or a transcript or some combination of the two. Those details are not particularly explored, and I think understandably so, because the state's position below and the state's position on appeal is that the entirety of the video, which is inclusive of the defendant's responses to questioning and the manner in which he responded, and I think as I get into the meat and bones of the exclusion issue, the timing and the relationship of the questioning and how defendant responds to those is really sort of essential to the state's desire to present that evidence before the court, and that simply presenting that evidence through means of another witness does not really get to the essence of what that evidence is, because that's such a recitation sort of neuters the effect of the video's contents and the manner in which the defendant made these responses. Now, the kind of the origins of this means to present evidence comes back to Truitt. And I think it's important here to discuss these cases and look at them, because especially as we get to Lee and Brindley from this court, because there's certainly some kind of comparison of these two cases, which causes some perhaps difficulties. But in Truitt is a 115-15 lab report case, and this is precedes the Supreme Court's ultimate declaration of unconstitutionality of that statute, where the lower court had excluded the report because it felt that it was unconstitutional and violated the Confrontation Clause. And the Supreme Court declined to hear the case on the basis of the fact that the state could have just presented the lab examiner. It was a witness within their means of producing, and it was a witness that would have presented the exact same evidence that the lab report itself would have presented. It bears perhaps some helpfulness to read the exact language of the court, because I do think it has some relationship to this case as well. Instead of being able to rely on a piece of paper, the state will have to present testimony from an actual witness. There's no way this can reasonably be viewed as a suppression. To the contrary, the witness will be subject to cross-examination. The jury will almost certainly end up receiving a much more thorough explanation of the pertinent facts than a document alone could provide. It may actually have the opposite effect of a suppression order. So there, of course, we've got an instance where the state has a witness that the state could put on, present the exact same evidence, and then, you know, in the court, I think reasonably comes to the conclusion that there's not really been a suppression of anything. The court followed up that with KEF, which is a 115-10 case, where the state, for some reason or another, decided not to present the entirety of the testimony of a child, which was a foundational prerequisite to admission of the Child Advocacy Center video in that case. Rather, the state just put the witness on, asked the witness simply whether everything on the video is accurate, and then left it at that, essentially depriving, opposing counsel the opportunity to cross-examine that witness. Ultimately, the court held that there, too, there's no jurisdiction because the state had at its disposal and within its exclusive means the ability to put on that witness on behalf of the state and could have shored up the foundation. It was really through the state's own malfeasance, if you will, that the state was now left in the position where it could have still simply just put on that child witness and presented the same exact evidence. So Truitt and KEF kind of follow the same sort of core analysis of evidence that's within the state's control that the state can put on the witness stand. Ultimately, then in Sneed, which is one of the most recent cases from this court, or excuse me, from the Supreme Court, the court sort of, again, in analyzing, among other cases, Lee, pointedly made note that there the state had, you know, the construct of the state, of the Supreme Court's analysis, is that where the other means is entirely within the state's control, the state can present that evidence, then there's no jurisdiction. Ultimately, they did find jurisdiction in that case. Now, this case obviously is a little bit different. The evidence in the state's control is not really the same as the evidence that would be presented by way of, say, a police officer, okay? The defendant's reactions and the verbal and nonverbal cues, the back and forth is not something that's going to be conveyed, and nor is it within the state's control, because the state obviously can't put the defendant on the witness stand and say, okay, let's go through all this again with you, okay? Now, having laid that backdrop, if you will, Your Honors, I want to talk a little bit about Lee and Brindley, because this is really what it kind of comes down to, is that, you know, Lee, a case that I argued myself, was, again, another 115-10 case where the court had excluded the video evidence, and the court had held, among other things, that that there's no jurisdiction because the state could have simply presented the witnesses that were in their control, which are the children, that could have testified, and therefore, because they can convey that same information that would have been presented by way of the CAC video, there's no jurisdiction. Now, I don't now agree with that, but it is obviously the law of the court. So in that vein, I do want to then focus at this point, as we talk about Lee and Brindley, on aspects of the defendant's, I think, position with regards to lack of jurisdiction. Now, defendant, I think, has three bases in which he asserts that there's no 604A appeal. I want to talk about the second one, which is that the state could have presented this other evidence by way of, say, the officer's testimony about what happened during the interrogation. Okay. In Brindley is a case where the state had excluded from, the court had excluded from evidence a recording, an overhear recording of an interaction between a confidential informant and the defendant, where the exchange of the transaction occurred. The court found that the state had not complied to the statutory prerequisites for the admission of that video. This court ultimately rejected the defendant's sort of Truitt-based, KEF-based argument and found that there was jurisdiction because the court had held there, and I've kind of block quoted it in the reply brief, where it says that the state sought relevant events as they occurred, and there's language, we're going to come back to that in a minute, capturing the defendant's exact words, demeanor, and visual manifestations, the time is alleged to have committed the crimes charged. The CI's testimony concerning the same is not the same evidence. It would be based on his or her recollection of the events, which may or not be the same as what is depicted in the recording, as well as the witness's credibility. And of course, the credibility issue is something I think that's very important, and I think it has to be emphasized in this case as well, because the credibility of the defendant's sort of exculpatory denials is something that is most definitely something that the jury has to be considering in assessing, you know, what happened in this case and whether those denials are trustworthy or not, given the evidence the state's likely going to present in this case. Now, what happened in Lee, and I think what happens here in this appeal by virtue of the defendant's argument, is there's a focus on the language in Brindley, which states that, you know, the testimony concerning the same events is not the same evidence, that the actual audio video recording of the relevant events as they occurred. So what Lee pointed out, and defendant does as well, is that there appears to be this language that says, well, this evidence is reviewable on appeal under 604A because it involves events that occurred at the same time. Now, I don't understand that. I still don't understand that, because what it seems to suggest is that there's jurisdiction if we have a video of a crime as it's being committed, but that in some other circumstance it's not admissible. Or is it really just a question of the contemporaneousness of the recording as it relates to information that the jury should be allowed to hear? In this case, I think Justice Overstreet's reference to the when that recording occurred was really only relevant to the factual circumstances of that case as they occurred, not necessarily that it was dispositive to the presence or lack thereof of the appellate court's jurisdiction. Because the balance of the court's Brindley analysis is really exactly on point here, that an officer's testimony about what the defendant said is not a replication or is not the same evidence as what the video occurs, all for the same reasons. Okay, the recollection of the event, the words, demeanor, visual manifestations, these are all things that the state has pointed to here as unique to the circumstances of this video, which are the same as were discussed in Brindley. This court in Brindley found that a person simply testifying to what they saw, which in this case would be the officer who was present and officers mm-hmm. that were present and participated in the interrogation, would be, I think, relaying information that would not sort of, you know, lay forth what the video shows. And moreover, it's going to be limited strictly to the subjective interpretation of the testifying witness's recollection.
Mr. Daly, I hate to cut you off, but you're well beyond your 10 minutes.
I am.
You are.
Oh my gosh.
Now,
I apologize.
That's all right. Obviously there's a lot to this case, both with the jurisdiction issue and the merits. So unless there is an objection from Justice McKinney or Justice Scholar, because I want the state and the defense to be able to provide us the argument that we need, obviously you're going to have your rebuttal time to address what Ms. Navee may talk about the merits. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to have the clerk add another 3 minutes to her time, so she can, you know, if she uses it, fine. If she doesn't, that's fine too. That's up to her. But that way she can talk about both arguments, and then you will have your rebuttal time to address those merits. Again, unless there's an objection, or if Justice Scholar or McKinney wants to give more time, I'm open to that as well.
I'm fine with how the presiding justice wants to proceed.
Yeah, I'm happy with that suggestion. Thank you.
Yeah, I apologize to the court and counsel. I was the clock is really small on my screen, so I couldn't see it very well. I'm sorry.
It is, and like I said, there's a lot of meat on the bone to this case. So I want to make sure you all have proper time to argue.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So with that, Mr. V, go right ahead.
Oh, great. Thank you. Your Honors, I'm going to cut to the chase because, as you said, there is a lot of meat on the bones of this case. So my name is Yasmin Navai, just briefly. I represent the appellee, Devin O'Daniel. And in this matter, the state is correct. There are two principal issues, one beginning with jurisdiction, and then we move on to the merits. With regards to jurisdiction, there's a line of cases. I agree that Truitt and KEF and this court's decision in Brindley and Lee, which proceeds, which comes after that, and which the state has acknowledged the holding of Lee, and even White, which was not addressed by the state. They have forfeited the opportunity to respond to that. That was a Fourth District case, a Rule 23 order, but it's very much consistent with the other cases. There are three factors which are relevant. One, first and foremost, we do not look at the substantive correctness of the ruling under this line of cases. We look only at whether the information is being presented from being presented to the trier of fact. Two, we look whether the state has control over the admissibility of this evidence. The state, I think, relies principally on the fact that there is an exclusion. I would contest that representation. The trial court here merely limited the use of a proposed video redaction, and at that, only at, during the case, the state's case in chief. So that leaves three critical options open. I'm going to turn to one of the most critical ones. The state has the opportunity, and in fact, the duty to submit a further redaction, one that is not unfairly prejudicial, and where the probative value outweighs the unfairly substantially prejudicial value. And I'll turn to that when I get to the merits in a moment. But with regards to that, so they have that principal opportunity. Not only that, but with respect to the proposed video itself, that too is not being suppressed. It's merely the means by which the state can introduce it in rebuttal should the defendant testify. Going back to the further redaction, the further redaction is completely within the state's control. And as I've highlighted in the appellee brief throughout, there are multiple sections of that video which inform the trial court's ruling that the probative value is substantially outweighed by the unfair prejudice, which can be excluded while leaving intact the statements of the defendant, which is what we're talking about. That is the information here. The argument that the proposed video is the information was in fact expressly rejected by this court, by the Illinois Supreme Court, let me back up, in KEF, and by this court in Lee. And I'd like to speak about Brindley because the state took up the bulk of its time on that. That case is easily distinguishable from the instant case. But I think even under the guiding principles under Lee, under Brindley, we see why the evidence in this case, why nothing is being suppressed and why this court does not have jurisdiction to hear this matter as in the first context.
Well, counsel, if the state is required to only submit the testimony of the officers and not the trier of fact would not see the video, isn't the trier of fact deprived of their a jury instruction that says you're entitled to review the demeanor of the witnesses who are testifying? Isn't that gutted here?
Your Honor, with respect to jurisdiction, I'm going to limit it to jurisdiction and then I'll discuss it with regards to the merits. With regards to jurisdiction, whether the defendant's demeanor in and of itself may be more persuasive is not at issue. We're not dealing with the correctness of the trial court's ruling. We're only dealing with, as far as jurisdiction goes, with regards to whether there's another opportunity. However, to allay your concerns, the state still has the opportunity to present visual evidence of the defendant's statements. If it presents a further redaction, which does not include the sections which the court highlighted and I think informs the trial court's decision that the unfair prejudice outweighs any probative value. There are significant sections in this redacted video, which include defendant not offering any evidence about the crime itself. So it doesn't go to his, whether he's guilty of the child's death or not, but in fact have him cursing at police officers when he's alone in substantial sections. It shows him in shackles. It shows him in shackles at the end of the interrogation. Also, uttering
yes. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No,
but, But back to the jurisdictional issue before we get into the merits. Isn't it the substantive effect of the court's ruling that really matters here? And essentially, didn't the court rule that the video itself, the 57-minute clip, was barred? Is that correct?
Your Honor.
In the case in chief?
No, in the case in chief. Yes, you're right. It is that it was limited in the case in chief. However, it is not the proposed video. That, in fact, that same argument was rejected by this court in Lee. The information, which is the key word in this, from all of these cases, is the defendant's statements. And even if we go at the defendant's visual statements, those are not necessarily excluded. The court made clear in its partial ruling and then later in its final ruling that its final order was limited to that proposed video redaction only, leaving in place the opportunity for the state to provide a further redaction. And we may be talking not about large swaths of the video being reduced, but sections where the defendant is alone and cursing to himself about the officers, a section at the end of the video where he is being arrested and is in shackles and is not being interrogated.
So jurisdiction may be proper if the video is further redacted? Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Not at all.
Help clarify that for me, please.
Let me be very clear. There is no jurisdiction in this appeal because the information is not being prevented from being presented to the trier of fact. The information is not being prevented because the state has the opportunity to submit a further redaction. So they still can introduce the defendant's videotape statement. The court hasn't excluded it, even in the case in chief. If the state, and in fact, the state's reply brief indicates that there's no requirement that the state provide a further redaction. Well, actually, we did cite several cases. In People v. White, the Fourth District Court found, in fact, that the state made the error by not offering a redacted version of the victim's statements in that case that it wanted to introduce. So this is on the state. This is entirely on the state. And it's within their control, which is, again, another consideration in determining whether any information is being barred and whether this court has jurisdiction. So to go back to your ultimate question, no, this court does not have jurisdiction. This court does not have jurisdiction because no information is being barred. We don't look at the proposed video redaction itself. But even then, and again, I return back to my response, it is not the correctness of the court's ruling. So any discussion of whether the video itself is more is more compelling or not is not at play when we're discussing with jurisdiction. That only comes into play with regards to the merits. And I would argue, in turning to the merits, that the question there is whether the trial court's ruling is arbitrary, fanciful, such that no reasonable trier of fact would find in the manner that the trial court did. With so many problematic sections in this proposed video redaction, and in fact, there are a line of cases which say, for example, and all of these, by the way, I might add, none of them with regards to the merits were addressed by the state. Andrade, Gregory, White, which was referenced in the jurisdictional section of the brief, no response by the state. All of these cases hold that when evidence is substantially is largely irrelevant or not, or even when relevant, if it's substantially prejudicial and unfairly prejudicial, then the probative value is outweighed and must be excluded before it's admitted to the trier of fact. Again, we don't want to risk the trier of fact finding an individual guilty based upon his disdain of police officers, for example, his anger, or that kind of propensity evidence, when it doesn't go to the ultimate question before the trier of fact, which is whether the defendant is guilty. And again, I say, the line of cases, Andrade, in the merit section, shows that yelling in and of itself is not evidence of bad conduct. And this kind of ties in with Brindley. I'm going to try and separate this out so that we're clear, but I'm going to stick to jurisdiction for a moment. I want to just make sure I address Brindley. In Brindley, the state's main objection, and I'm talking about jurisdiction now, the state's main objection is that in Brindley, the demeanor at the time of the offense, the lead court's determination that Brindley was different because it was timing. It showed the defendant's crime at the time of the offense. His demeanor at the time of the offense doesn't make sense. But in point of fact, it does. In Brindley, the court completely barred any video audio evidence of the overhear because of illegality on the state's part. In this case, however, there's no barring or exclusion or suppression of the videotaped interrogation. There is a limitation of the use of a proposed video redaction. That's a critical distinction between those two cases. And in point of fact, there is a difference with behavior at the time of the offense and behavior and conduct after the offense, as the court in Andrade found. Just because a person is yelling after the offense does not necessarily prove that he was the initial aggressor in that case. In this case, we can liken it, defendant's anger towards the police officer is after the offense, is not necessarily indicative of his guilt. His anger could be directed at multiple things. And in point of fact, we have a father whose child is on the way to St. Louis, is hurt. He doesn't know the condition. He keeps repeating this. He also indicates multiple times that he's exhausted. Now, in this record, we have evidence that this defendant has had an untreated seizure disorder, and there was evidence that seizure disorder causes exhaustion. So there's multiple reasons why his behavior is not ipso facto, his behavior after the offense, I might add, is not ipso facto bearing on whether he's guilty or not. But again, the state has the opportunity of presenting the vast majority of the visual statements that the defendant makes, particularly in the second interrogation when he's much calmer. They cited a section where he talked about where defendant is demonstrating the fall that the child has. He remained consistent, I might add, with his account in both the first and second interrogation. All of that can come in. It is just a small sections where his outbursts and his physical displays maybe are so irrelevant to the issue at hand. And even if relevant, the danger of unfair prejudice is substantially outweighed by the probative value. There's also nothing in this trial court ruling to suggest that there was an abuse of discretion. The trial court, in its final order, cited with specificity two sections where the defendant engages in very visible hostile behavior, screams out, "Just take me to jail." That's paragraph 3 of the court's final order. Paragraph 4 of the court's final order indicates with specificity, "This is why I told her not to call the cops." So these are with specific references to the defendant's statements, which are not probative of his guilt or innocence in this case.
Ms. Navide, I'm going to have you wrap it up here shortly.
Okay, one last thing. And just the last thing I want to point out is these sections, the court indicates that the sections after the interrogation and when he's left alone are substantially, the unfair prejudice is substantially outweighed by the probative value. So the trial court's ruling is not an abuse of discretion. Thank you very much. We ask that this court affirm the circuit court's ruling below and find no jurisdiction.
Thank you, counsel. Before we go back to Mr. Daly, Justice Scholar or Justice McCaney, do you have any questions?
Nothing. I don't have any.
No questions.
All right. I think the clerk is getting the clock set. We're back to the disco lighting going on.
Yeah, I can read it fine if she can start the clock. It's fine with me.
Okay. Then go right ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. So in looking at the court,
can I bother you first? I'd like to interrupt you. I'd like for you to address counsel's statement about the video being within the state's control and the issue of the redaction and further redaction.
Okay, thank you, Judge. That's actually where I was going to start. So
okay, great.
So let's do a couple aspects of this that I want to get into. First of all, so looking at the court's final order, and then a counsel says, "Well, you know, we're not talking about an exclusion of evidence, but a limitation on it." So, but in paragraph 9 of the court's final order, plaintiff shall not be allowed to present a video interview of plaintiff in its case in chief. So, I mean, that's quite a limitation. It's a wholesale limitation, exclusion of the video itself. So rolling back from that part of the final order to the previous parts, counsel says, well, you know, we can, there's certain redactions that the state could have made to this video as, I guess, a prerequisite to jurisdiction, I suppose, or not as a prerequisite maybe, but it could have done instead of appealing. The court does in a couple paragraphs make note of a couple instances that the court took note of. In paragraph 4, it says at approximately 2:46 a.m., defendant states, "This is why I told her not to call the cops," and other substantially prejudicial comments, of which I have no idea what they are. There must be a lot, but we don't know. So as a threshold, I guess, response to the argument is that if redaction is a viable argument here, is some sort of means of precluding jurisdiction, I'm not sure exactly what those redactions are. Counsel certainly has a lot of ideas what those redactions are, but of course the state's not required to listen to what the defendant suggests ought to be excluded. And the court hasn't provided any guidance in that regard. But I think all that sort of elides a major point here. And that is that the state wanted to present and appealed the court's order of the defendant's responses and reactions to the questioning that took place in this case. So if I understand defendant's argument correctly, it's that, well, this court should not allow the state to appeal because what it could have done is just simply redacted the video to take out everything that it wanted to appeal in the first place, and then we're all good to go. Well, in other words, I guess the state isn't allowed to appeal under 604A because apparently in order to get jurisdiction, we have to comply with the court's order and not have the opportunity to challenge its correctness or its inaccuracies or lack of legal basis. I just don't think that argument flies as a matter of precluding jurisdiction. If it were simply a matter of the state saying, well, okay, I guess you're right, maybe we should take all that out, that's fine. They could have done it at the first place. Or the state said, we don't think we have to take all that stuff out, whatever it is, because we think that aspect of the video, for reasons that we've gone into in more detail in the substantive part of our argument, are challengeable because they're incorrectly determined by the court to have been created a more substantially prejudicial environment versus the clear probative value of what those statements contain, inclusive of the defendant's responses to the officer's questioning in this case, okay? I mean, interrogations don't occur in a vacuum, okay? We can't take a video necessarily, and while redactions occur all the time in law, criminal and civil, I'm sure, redactions still have to result in a product which is somewhat comprehensible. And chopping up a video like this to satisfy some need to remove information, which by my understanding, the court's order is so woven into this case that it may be impossible to do anyway, simply doesn't fly. So I think the answer to your question, Justice Scholar, is that I think that my response is that this is not a jurisdictional aspect. Okay. The jurisdictional aspect is, was there something that was excluded? And certainly something here is excluded. Everything was excluded. Okay. But critically, the parts of the video that the defendant felt were unfair to the defendant, and the court apparently agreed, are part and parcel of that, which the state is now challenging, was incorrectly decided. So I don't think that there's any basis or legal authority, and I don't read White to say that at all, regardless of counsel's arguments here, that the state is somehow as a prerequisite to jurisdiction or as a bar to jurisdiction should have first done what the defendant told, what the state said it should have done, or defendant told the state what it should do. So that aspect of it as well, and I've already got into the second part, and there's 20 seconds I have left. The defendant also argues that, you know, well, the state had the opportunity to present this in rebuttal, et cetera. Well, you know what, Your Honors, if you're gonna present evidence in rebuttal, you gotta have something to rebut. The state can't call the defendant to the witness stand unless the Fifth Amendment is going to get repealed between now and trial, and I don't think that's going to happen. So I don't think that either of those two aspects are really very have much traction. I think that the focus of this court really has to be upon that other means of presentation of evidence, the whether the reading of it or some other transmission of the information contained in this somehow satisfies the same evidence. And I just don't think that it does. And I think this court's decision in Brindley really lays down the logic of that particular aspect of this. Does court have any questions? And I'll wrap it up here.
Justice McKinney, Justice Scholar, any questions?
No.
No questions.
Your Honors, one last thing. I didn't have really much of a chance to talk about the substantive aspect of the court's ruling, but I would request the court that I'd stand on my arguments in this case, which I think adequately rebut defendant's position here.
Well, thank you, counsel. I would say that you did a fine job, both of you, today on these issues. We've said this already. There's a lot to this case, both the jurisdiction issue and the merits. So I appreciate your thoroughness and your being overly prepared today. So I appreciate that. And I know I speak for the other panel members here today. Obviously, we will take the matter under advisement. We will issue an order in due course.